But also, Francis, the electric power system is a climate solution. And in many ways, it is the climate solution. There
Right.
is no path to a clean energy future without a vastly larger decarbonized power grid.
Welcome to the Flux Capacitor, a podcast about the future of electricity. I'm Francis Bradley of Electricity Canada. This is number 116, episode 116 of the Flux Capacitor. I've been chatting with the industry's business leaders, thought leaders, new market players, and stakeholders, the folks that have been pondering the future of how we create, move, trade, and use energy, and what the future changes will mean for electricity companies, regulators, society, and customers. I hope these conversations have given you, the listener, a sense of the conversations that are taking place in the sector. My two guests on the podcast today are
Peter Fox Penner, a principal in the Brattle Group in Washington, D.C. and San Francisco.
Tom Chapman, a principal in the Toronto office.
Peter and Tom join me for a conversation about the challenges and solutions facing the electric utility sector. This is a follow-up to an excellent keynote Peter gave at the annual Camput Conference, the Canadian Association of Regulators, this past May in Halifax. Among the challenges we discuss are rapid load growth, affordability, and the need for decarbonization. Peter highlights the impact of climate change, citing deaths from excessive heat and hundreds of billions in lost labor productivity. We also discuss the rise of data centers and the additional pressure on demand as a result. Solutions? They include leveraging existing technologies, integrated distribution planning, and exploring public-private partnerships to address these challenges. We close the conversation with a couple of great book recommendations. Here is my conversation with Peter Fox Penner and Tom Chapman, recorded on Zoom on June 25th, 2025. Peter and Tom, thank you for joining the podcast. I'm glad that you were able to make it. And Peter, we triggered this appointment to have this conversation for the podcast as a result of a presentation that you gave at the Camput Conference in Halifax, Nova Scotia, in May. You were presenting a paper that the Brattle Group had done that I furiously scribbled notes the whole time you were talking. Right. And then afterwards, in the hallway, I said to you, man, this would make a great podcast. And so here you are. So maybe start off with, just for the listener, the Brattle Group. What is the Brattle Group for somebody who doesn't know?
The Brattle Group is an economic and financial consultancy with nine offices around the world, including Washington, D.C. and Toronto. Mm-hmm. And we have a very large practice in energy, all forms of energy, and a particular specialization in economics and regulation and technology in the rapidly evolving and extremely important electric power sector.
All right. Rapidly evolving. And that was, I guess, the kind of the topic of the report that you were talking about. Can you tell us a little bit about the report and then let's dive into some of the specifics?
Sure. The report is called Clean Capital Efficiency, and it's up on the Brattle Group website at brattle.com. And it's sort of a look at the challenges facing electric distribution utilities, I think across North America and Europe. In big picture, Francis, those challenges have to do with the tensions between rapid load growth, affordability, a high cost environment, and an extremely important need to continue our progress towards climate safety, decarbonization, and resilience.
Yeah,
why don't we? Big picture, that's what the paper's about.
And then you had those four big challenges at the front end, and then you talked about solution elements. So why don't we take those challenges one by one? And do you want to maybe let's start off with the last one you mentioned, because it was the first one you talked about when you were in Halifax, and that was the climate change. And so what does that challenge look like for the sector? And you said you were looking at it really through the lens of distribution companies, correct?
Well, yes, but of course, the distribution companies need to get their hands on power supplies, much of it from the larger transmission and generation systems. So, I'm really talking about when I talk about decarbonization, the whole system. We're gonna, I think, for the foreseeable future, far into the future, Francis, get the majority of our power delivered from large power sources and through the transmission system. So decarbonization requires generation investments, large ones, involving renewables and nuclear and other forms of decarbonized energy, as well as a big expansion of the transmission system. But all of that's got to get paid for ultimately by the customers on distribution systems, because that's where people get connected to the grid and pay their bills.
So let's start off with the climate challenge. I mean, I do recall you had some statistics there that emphasize that this isn't just some, theoretical challenge that we're facing. I think in your talk you were actually talking about, the number of fatalities and some other stats as well that came into play.
Yes, climate change used to be talked about as something that was going to affect our grandchildren. I'm sure you remember that, Francis, and Tom does, back in the day. And now we're living through an era where we're experiencing climate change. I'm in Washington, D.C. on the third day in a row where the heat index is above 100. And the epidemiologists and climate experts have been doing a lot of looking into this and concluded that excessive heat is already killing 12,000 Americans a year. I could not believe those numbers. That's in a peer-reviewed medical journal that's up on the website and our slides. Climate's also causing enormous losses in labor productivity as people can't work outside or must work less. $835 billion worth of losses last year. By the public health expert estimates. So climate change is unfortunately here, and it's going to get worse before it gets better. And that makes it really, really essential to decarbonize the electric grid. But also, Francis, the electric power system is a climate solution. And in many ways, it is the climate solution. There is no path to a clean energy future without a vastly larger decarbonized power grid. And that sort of leads into sort of part of the second challenge, which is that we have to grow the grid at about 2.7% a year to get to a large enough grid to supply the transportation and clean electric buildings and clean industrial processes that we're going to need by 2050 or in that range. So we have a real imperative to grow the system and clean up the system that we just can't afford to avoid.
Right. And so that 2.7 a year upon year compounding, that brings us to a doubling out to 2050, basically, right?
About that.
And then also contributing to the demand, and you talked about this in Halifax, is the rise of data centers and what that's adding to in terms of the challenge. What's that looking like from your perspective?
Well, the latest reports from the states are that the data center queues are an astonishing 138 gigawatts. Now, we just simply won't be able to build anywhere near that. The Lawrence Berkeley Labs' estimates, which I think are continue to be some of the best estimates out there, still show that by 2038, data center consumption will be somewhere between 7 and 12% of all US electricity. And even at 7%, as I mentioned in Halifax, it's a little mind-boggling to think that one out of every 15 kilowatt hours used in the United States is being used in a data centers that occupy probably 1/1,000th of 1% of the, or 1/100,000th of 1% of all the land in the United States. So data center demand, which of course is very important, is adding an enormous new layer of challenge to the need for clean electrification and system expansion.
And then the final challenge that you talked about, and it's certainly one that I hear a lot about from my members as well, is with respect to equipment costs and delays, supply chains. That's another one that is not getting any better anytime soon, right?
Well, not that we can see at the Brattle Group. Producer price indexes are up somewhere between a doubling since 2018 and 3x since 2018. Some transformers even more than that. And most of the suppliers that we know, well, some of them are able to alleviate the bottlenecks and expand. And there are some things, Francis, where costs continue to go down. Lithium-ion batteries just continue to drop in costs, and our intelligence in Brattle shows that that trend still has some runway. Some solar equipment costs, ex tariffs, are also continuing to come down. So there are some scale economies that we're going to realize, and that's a good thing. We hope nuclear costs will come down as you get from first of a kind to nth of a kind units. There are scale economies to be reaped in our industry for certain as we move down the experience curve. But we also have resource constraints that we can't alleviate easily in rare earths, metals, and just plain manufacturing equipment. In for transformers and semiconductors and things like that, where it's a major multi-year commitment to expand production capacity, and many of the global manufacturers aren't willing to expand as fast as our industry is demand is growing.
Now, Tom, maybe if I could just turn to you for a moment. I think Peter has really set the table quite well for us to like start talking about solutions. But before we do that, interested to kind of get your perspective, because as I listen to Peter, talk about these challenges of climate change, demand, data centers, and supply chain challenges. At least from my perspective, they sound just as relevant in Canada as they are south of the border.
Well, yes, Francis, I'd like to say that we don't have all those same problems that Peter's dealing with south of the border. But the reality is, as I think we all know, just anecdotally, we're being impacted by climate change. We've seen historic droughts, we've seen wildfires, multiple provinces. And Canada, a lot of the Canadian electricity system is vulnerable to these weather events. We're a very large mass population centers and concentrated with a lot of wires that can be heavily impacted by extreme weather events. So I think we're very sensitive up here in Canada to the impacts of climate change. And at the same time, we're seeing that growing demand for electricity. In some provinces, it's similar to the data center driving load growth, but across all the provinces, we're seeing electrification, we're seeing fuel switching, we're seeing economic activity driving up demand for electricity. And the utilities and the regulators and the policymakers understand that they have to build out that enabling infrastructure to allow this to happen. And I know, having spoken to a number of the utilities when we were working with you last year on our reliability project. It's such a challenge for the utilities to try and balance these tensions of trying to keep rates affordable, but invest and maintain the grid that they have, but then also expand it so that they can incorporate and accommodate all these new loads that want to connect. So, yes, I guess we have as have a bigger challenge, even though Canada's, been blessed with a lot of hydro resources. I think we do need to do a better job of moving that power to some of the provinces that are still reliant on fossil fuels. BC is next to Alberta. There's a good opportunity there in the Atlantic Canada. Got a lot of hydropower in that region. Could be helping out Nova Scotia and New Brunswick. And I think there's tremendous opportunity if you have that enabling infrastructure to help solve each other's problems, I guess, is one way of putting it.
Okay, so let's talk about some of those solution elements that Peter, you spoke about
Right.
and that are in the report.
Yeah. Hey, Francis, before we get there, could I comment on one thing Tom mentioned that I think is really quite important to the whole landscape? And that is the result of all of these challenges hitting CapEx budgets for utilities and then rates and then the affordability challenge, just to complete the picture of challenges. And this, of course, is in the Clean Capital Efficiency paper, but all of these drivers are forcing CapEx budgets up to unprecedented levels, plus $220 billion a year utility-wide CapEx budgets, which is double 2014, just 10 years ago. And the projections are that those rates of CapEx growth will continue to set records year after year, at least as far as we have visibility into budgets, which is about 5 years out. And that's translating into adding that CapEx into rate base and to rate increases, which are really reaching historically high levels. One utility I was looking at is forecasting 9% a year for the next 3 years. Another utility just put in a 10% rate increase and thinks it could hit 40%. And of course, we know that many, many families are living on stretched budgets already. The econ We've had a bout of inflation, and voters and citizens are very unhappy with it already. And there may be likely to be another round of inflation from tariffs, or at least tariff uncertainty of affecting the supply chains. So affordability is really a front and center issue as we cope with all these other challenges. And I just wanted to round out the picture there.
And you spoke about this and talked about some of the things that companies should be looking at doing to respond to this, squeezing as much energy and throughput out of existing systems, demonstrating greater efficiency. You did also, note that there's some challenges here with respect to social license. What is a utility executive to do when faced with this challenge?
Well, I think a very large portfolio of actions is needed on both the demand side and the supply side. The main point of the paper was to make sure that utilities maximize what you might say is the efficiency and throughput potential on the demand side, because we're just up against constraints on the ability to expand, the pace of expansion, the pace of decarbonization, and the affordability constraints, all of which tell us that We need to do everything we can to get as much efficiency and throughput out of the system that we have, which, as you and I said, is primarily the distribution system, the transmission and distribution system. Generators are pretty efficient, and they're already incentivized to increase their efficiency, and they're working on that. But the rest of the system isn't as easy, and there are unharvested opportunities that I think we need to work on with greater force.
So there's the obvious. There's things like energy efficiency programs. New technologies, virtual power plants, aggregating load, those sorts of things. Is that what the future is going to look like? Is that how we're going to be addressing this? Tom, you wanted to weigh in here?
Yeah, I get quite excited about this because there's such an opportunity, I think, to solve a lot of these problems. The technology is already there in many cases, and the interest is there too. It takes a bit of time, I think, to turn around a supertanker that is the sort of the utility industry, and so trying to find ways to make that process easier, I think, is going to be really important. And I think part of this, I mean, just to give an example, right now, there's a lot of interest in rolling out heat pumps. So great opportunity to decarbonize and heat your home in a different way or cool your home. There's also a ton of interest in electric vehicles, and they're being sold by the truckload, and they're on parking garages and parking lots. But the policies are still separate and siloed. So all the work we've been doing recently is, well, what if a utility started using those vehicles as a way to offset the electricity demand from a heat pump so that you could have a flatter load profile for a typical home? And starting to think a little bit more holistically about some of the opportunities and aligning some of the policies and making it easier for the utilities, working with the regulators to actually put in place solutions for the homeowner and for the grid. I think that's going to be tremendously important to try and realize the types of benefits that Peter's outlining, to do more with less, to capture some of the efficiency savings. It's going to really take, it's a little less on the technology solutions. I think the technology is mostly there. It's how do you sort of operationalize it within the existing utility construct that we have? That's going to be the challenge.
And it's a question that I've been asking for quite some time, given like I've got an electric vehicle, and so basically 95% of the time, there's this 82 kilowatt battery that's connected to my house doing nothing.
Yes,
And
so for the
surely,
asset. Yeah.
surely there will be some way for, me and the couple of hundred thousand people that are now driving EVs in
Exactly.
Canada, that we'd be able to make use of that. So it's I think it's interesting, you suggest that it's not necessarily a question of technology. So the challenge is, how do we turn that supertanker? So Peter, how do we turn the supertanker?
Well, first thing I want to say is I think the supertanker is turning. If you look at our work in Brattle Group across the electricity sector, it is the most diverse and exciting book of business we've ever had in the truly, because I've been around since pretty much the start of the company. And we are getting lots of work with utilities to look at how to expand these solutions, as well as expand the transmission system more quickly and integrate in new sources of generation. So the carrier is turning. How can we turn it more quickly? And that is the question of the day. I think Tom is correct that we definitely need to we need very deep integration between our regulators, our utilities, and the outside stakeholders who are have understandably a lot of concerns about where ratepayer money is going and what utilities are up to and whether profit levels are fair. But we can't afford to fight in silos and do things like have a two-year fight about our energy efficiency programs over here and a different discussion about our storage incentive over here. When really, as you pointed out with your example of your heat pump and your automobile, what really harvests the benefits of all these technologies is planning and implementing on an integrated basis in the distribution system, where all of these solutions have a role to play and they can reduce the CapEx needed to expand the distribution system by lowering and balancing demands. Right. They can even send power back up to the system to save the need to relieve the bottlenecks, you might say, on transmission and distribution and so on. So I think the word of the day, Francis, should be integrated, comprehensive integrated distribution planning, using all of these tools. If I might, Francis, I also want to make one comment in response to Tom's observation that many of the technologies are already available. That is absolutely true, but it's also the case that there are a lot of new technologies that are coming on quickly and are really under-recognized and underutilized. And some of the existing technologies continue to get much better, and yet people don't understand that. Heat pumps are a good example, and EVs themselves, where they're getting much better and cheaper every year.
Right.
But then there are new technologies like these grid-enhancing technologies that are only used and a fraction of the transmission lines that we have, including those big long lines in Canada, Tom, that aren't really some of the biggest and best in North America, but a lot of them don't have this advanced technology on them yet.
Mm-hmm. But can you unpack that a little bit? What do you mean, or maybe an example of what grid enhancing technologies you're thinking about when you're talking about the transmission system?
Well, there's a whole suite of advanced transmission technologies, and Tom may have a few to talk about, but it begins with advanced conductors.
Okay.
Reconductoring can add 30% to the capacity of a line relatively quickly without a lot of change out in the towers and the transmission route and things like that. There is software that can control dynamically the flow over lines in response to weather conditions and even outages elsewhere in the system, and can essentially redispatch the transmission system. Mm-hmm. So you have dynamic line ratings as well as topology redispatch.
Yeah.
And all of these things I'm talking about are really not widely utilized at all yet.
Right. Right. What's the barrier? Why are they not widely used?
Well, there's several barriers, and barriers is a little strong word, but they're relatively new. Many transmission engineers don't have experience with them. They want to try them out and make sure they work on their system for sure, or at least see them work on other systems. You know, the power grid is a 24/7, 365 most critical of all critical infrastructures.
Yeah.
So electric reliability engineers are appropriately a conservative lot when it comes to new technologies. In this case, we just need to accelerate the education, the piloting, financing of these technologies, make sure that the incentives are there. The supply chain that we talked about earlier, Francis, some of these things are not that widely available yet. So across the board, there are many, many factors involved in getting these technologies more widely deployed, especially on the transmission grid.
So apart from technologies, and we've chatted a little bit about that. One of the other things that you talked about in terms of solutions was looking at leveraging other capital tools. And I'm not a finance guy, but I sense there really is something here. But I maybe ask you to try and explain it to a non-finance guy what this means. I know you talked about, what moves on to the balance sheet, what moves off to the off the balance sheet, and those sorts of things. So I know there's something real here. But for a non-financial person, what does that look like?
Well, I think we can understand it pretty simply. If we simply think about this, for much of my career, the utilities could raise all the capital they needed because utilities are just one of the best investments you can make. I'm not trying to plug that. Why I can't even personally invest in them, but they are critical infrastructure. We need power. If they need capital to build something and generate or deliver power, the investment community is usually willing to give them the capital. And that's true, I think Tom would say, whether you're a provincial corporation up in Canada or an investor-owned utility or a cooperative down here in the US, a municipal utility. So we never really thought about utilities needing other sources of capital other than the debt and equity that they would routinely issue and they continue to issue. But now the capital needs and this need to accelerate the transition and cope with these challenges is so great that if that in some cases philanthropic investors even and governments in one form or another are stepping up to say, let's make some capital available to the utilities directly to do some like essentially public-private partnerships, or let's create a loan guarantee as we did here in the United States under Jigar Shah at the Department of Energy. There are lots of vehicles by which public capital and philanthropic capital can supplement utility capital, particularly in niches that are more difficult for the utilities to finance themselves. And that's what I meant by leveraging other capital pools.
Okay. Yeah, Tom.
No, I've seen this firsthand, I guess, here in Ontario. There's just such a gulf between the municipally owned utilities' ability to raise capital and pay a dividend to the municipal council that pays for all sorts of local services, and have to raise such huge sums to invest in a distribution grid compared to infrastructure funds that can tap global capital markets and deploy that capital very quickly and efficiently. And so I don't know what the solution is, but that I think just generally trying to find ways to leverage the best of both worlds, create partnership opportunities, will go a long way. I guess a really interesting case study is Hydro One. 10 years ago, maybe it was 12 years ago, 100% provincially owned. Fast forward to today, it's now 50-50 province owned. I think a minority, but it's a traded utility. It's undertaking at least 10 very large transmission projects simultaneously, something it could never have done 15 years ago. It's now worth 2.5 times it was when it was, partially floated 10 years ago. So the market is valuing a much more dynamic organization that can access global capital. And I think it's a really good example of how if you get, and it doesn't have to be, privatization, because that can be a sensitive word, but there can be other partnerships, but just a way of leveraging the local utility benefits with sort of access to deep capital pools. I think finding ways to do that will be pretty key, I think, to investing and unlocking the infrastructure opportunities.
And what's interesting about that, Tom, is that's a government utility leveraging a new capital pool, namely private capital.
Exactly, yeah. That's exactly what it's
Here in
about.
the in the in the, here in the US, it's a little bit the opposite, but in
Yeah.
both cases, I think they're really positive developments.
Yeah, terrific. Listen, one of the things that I ask everybody that comes on the podcast is for a book recommendation. And so we've assembled the book recommendations. So we put it on our Flux Capacitor book club. So I'm going to ask both of you, I'll start with you, Tom, for a recommendation for a book to add to people's reading list.
Well, one I can highly recommend is by a Canadian author and explorer called Adam Schultz. I don't know if you've heard of him, Francis, but he's written a number of books about his exploits traveling around Canada, usually in a canoe.
Oh,
And
yes, yeah.
I had the opportunity to hear him speak at an event, and then just read his books avidly one after the other. They're just such great books. Anyway, the one that I really like is A History of Canada in 10 Maps. I'm a big fan of maps myself, but there's just so much storytelling around these maps, and it really helps you understand how Canada, developed over the centuries. And he has just such an interesting way of describing, that journey and then his journey exploring, the waterways of Canada. So I'd highly recommend that book, A History of Canada in 10 Maps by Adam
Adam
Schultz.
Schultz. Excellent. Excellent. Thank you. We'll add that to our reading list. And as the Canadian among my two guests, you're on brand suggesting and recommending a Canadian author. So Peter, who would you suggest we add to the reading list today?
Well, if this isn't the oddest book recommendation you've gotten all year,
Okay.
Francis, I will buy dinner. But I was introduced to a book called Infinite Baseball by Alva Noe, N-O-E. Noe is a professional university-based philosophy professor. But at the same time, he is a m maniacal baseball fan. So he has written a book of essays that is deeply philosophical about how baseball is played. And you will either love this book or hate it. But I found it really, really interesting.
Wow. Okay. So two recommendations. The first one is A History of Canada in 10 Maps by Adam Schultz. And the second one is Infinite Baseball, Notes from a Philosopher at the Ballpark by Alva Noe. Fantastic. Well, Peter, Tom, thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking the time to jump on the podcast. And I appreciated the opportunity to dig a little bit deeper than just that little talk you gave in Halifax at Camput. Thanks for joining the pod.
Thanks for having
Thanks,
us, Frank.
Francis. Yeah,
Great
thank you.
talking to you.
For those that have been with the podcast since the beginning, and those that have joined along the way, thanks for listening. Tune in for future podcasts, and please take the time to rate the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen. And let me know what you think of the Flux Capacitor. You can find me through our website at electricity.ca, on LinkedIn, and on Instagram as the Brad Bradley. The website for this pod is thefluxcapacitor.ca, and it includes links for this episode on the show page. This being episode 116. And while you're there, check out the book club page, which provides info on and links to the books which have been recommended by guests on the Flux Capacitor, including Tom's recommendation, A History of Canada in 10 Maps, Epic Stories of Charting a Mysterious Land by Adam Schultz, and Peter's recommendation, Infinite Baseball, Notes from a Philosopher at the Ballpark by Alva Noe. And let's continue the electricity conversation on our Facebook page, on Instagram, and at electricity.ca.